Before we begin, we wanted to issue a content warning for this week's episode. There is a frank discussion of sexual violence, assault, and trauma that some may find disturbing.
Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Happy October, Fright School. Oh my gosh, so exciting. It's that time. It's spooky season. We are here. We are in it. Kicking off our official, Halloween month shows. Oh, so excited to see you, Joe. How are you?
Good holiday tidings to you, Joshua.
Don't you just love this time of year? Like, I was watching, we were watching Food Network, and they, because they did the Worst Cooks in America, like Halloween redemption thing.
Oh,
and
no.
Like every commercial was like filled with spooky shit. You know, all the shows are doing their Halloween Wars stuff, you know, cakes that look like horror things, cupcakes, candies, baked goods, food,
dumplings.
Everything. I'm sure dumplings, just everything. I just love this time of year when everybody becomes spooky as fuck. It's just delightful.
I love it. I love it.
Don't you? Don't you enjoy it? You know,
I mean, I enjoy it because, like, I now own the title of Spooky Kook. Hard fought that it was. I think what I enjoy most is that, like, you know, this is the time of year where, like, your skin is glowing, Joshua. You are at the height of your, power. It's like,
it does feel like that.
You know, it's like, you know, like the New Year's baby, but it's like a Halloween baby. You know, mm-hmm. you're in the prime of your life.
Yeah, spook show baby. Yeah. Thank you, Rob Zombie.
So I'm very excited for this October. And there's a lot of stuff going on, so let's get to it.
Yes, let's get to it. Let's get to it. Let's get all of the things,
mainline it into my blood.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
Cut my throat and splatter that blood all over the wall.
Hot. Yeah, the Wes Craven Memorial Library needs a paint job. I think that'd be perfect. You know.
Oh my God! I
have to keep the walls wet.
Yeah, I sent a video to Justine because, you know, as you know, our dear friend Justine is a calligrapher, and I saw this weird video on Facebook that was like, "You'll never forget this man's calligraphy," and he's like using a knife, the like tip of a knife to, and it looks like blood, but it's like, you know, very crimson red ink. And he's using it to write out, like, "I love you."
I saw that. Yeah.
Have you seen that? But it looks like, it looks deranged, of course, because it's, you know, the blood is spattering everywhere.
That's the one where it was like a million little boxes, too. And they kept writing. Oh, man, that was kind of creepy. I dug it.
The obsession one.
Yeah.
There was one where it was the knife and he wrote down, "I loved you."
Yeah.
It's like, ugh, the past tense.
Yeah. No, I saw that going around. I was like, "Ooh, that is delightful." Like, you know, doing calligraphy with a knife.
We need to get him. We need to get a commission so that we can have him do, have him write out like the Wes Craven Memorial Library, and then we'll get it framed.
Yeah, I'm here for that. Let's do it. Let's reach out. let's see what else has been going on this week. American Horror Story, ending the first part last week. We're going to start anew, or we did start. It actually happened last week, last Wednesday. Aliens. But because we are manipulating time, we've yet to see it.
We're bending of time. We're time benders.
Yes, because, dear listener, Joe has the audacity to have the caucasity even. She's like, you know, internalizing the colonialism, you know, but she has the audacity to go have a life of her own. And it's conflicting with our scheduling, our recording scheduling. So we are manipulating time. We are the manipulated living. If you had seen Donnie Darko, you would understand what I'm talking about, Joe.
I mean, I have seen Donnie Darko, but I don't think I've seen it enough to know, like, the specific quotations other than, like, cellar door and, you know, doubting your commitment to Sparkle Motion.
There you go. That's all you need to know. Actually, we're going to have to do that movie one day. Like, I don't know how, like, how much it qualifies as, like, horror. I mean, again, what qualifies, right? It is kind of, it's very disturbing. There's lots of existential dread in it, you know.
I mean, according to our podcast, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer claymation animation is
That's true. That's horror. That is Fright School canon.
You had a lot to say about the, like, you know, inherited trauma of of the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yeah, so that's true. So, I mean, one day we'll do it, because it is personally one of my favorite films. So I, yeah, we'll have to do that one day. But what else is going on? You see anything this week? Watch any films?
What did I watch? I haven't watched any films. I'm trying to get caught up in TV, because there's so much new stuff. I'm at a point now where, like, you know, every time I'm... you know, every month or so I go through like what's coming up on Netflix or Hulu, Amazon, and I just like start saving things to add to my list. And I'm at a point now for like for all of September, it was like, this thing is now playing. The thing on your list is now here. And I haven't watched any of it. Like, oh, wow. I haven't watched any Nailed It. I haven't watched any of the, like, you know, the new seasons of all the different shows that I like. I think the only thing that I'm watching right now live is Dancing with the Stars.
Ah.
But, like, I also, like, secretly, well, not secretly, because I talk about it all the time on podcasts, but I love Dancing with the Stars because it's so dumb. It's, like, so stupid. Like, these celebrities loosely get right on there and, like, my favorite challenge that they have is like the theme of the week is like your most memorable year. And then in the, like, you know, package before they dance, they talk about, you know, their most memorable year. And then they're going to like represent that year, but like through dancing. And my favorite is when it's like, my most memorable year is the year that my dad passed away from cancer. And then they go into this very, you know, he was my champion. He believed in me. He took me to my first audition. It's like, Dad, I hope you like this. This is for you. And then it's like a rumba, which is like a very sensual Latin dance to like your father dying of pancreatic cancer. Which is so, and it happens a lot. It happens way more than people think. Or it's like, there was one where last season there was, my most memorable year is the year that my family came from Vietnam and my uncle was in a fishing boat. And, you know, single-handedly saved all our family's life because he bailed out the boat because they almost drowned. This dance is dedicated to him. And it was like a samba, like it was dancing the samba.
Well, I mean, it's just so it's so moving.
I know. I was like, you know, and then but like you're watching them and it's like, OK, so let's communicate all of the like. All of the sheer intensity of emotion, you know, that comes with family loss and immigrating to a new nation, but like also like, you know, articulate your hips and point your foot and like gesture wildly with your hands and stuff. It's just, it's the best.
Yeah, clearly. Well, I'm glad that you have that to enjoy as a, you know, an antidote to the horror, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was when I remember when we watched American Mary, I was very happy to have back episodes of Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. That's,
take me
that's,
out of it.
That is probably a good one to have on hand.
We should do a Dancing with the Stars where it's just horror celebrities. Can you imagine? It's like, you know, Mick Garris and Robert Mukes and Danielle Fisher.
I'm here for that. Let's pitch it. Let's get it going. You know,
brought to you by the Boulé brothers,
right? I love it. We started watching Only Murders in the Building.
Oh, is it good?
It's really funny. Okay. I feel super called out by it as a true crime podcast listener. There's a lot of snark in it at our demographic. I'm sure the murderinos watching it are like, excuse me, okay? Excuse me. Like, how can you put so much disrespect on me here, you know? So there are moments like that where it's just, you know, especially in the very first episode I was watching with the Sam Squanch, and he doesn't listen. I've tried to get him to listen to Serial. Mm-hmm. You know, I've tried to get him to listen to Accused from like the Cincinnati Inquirer, which I really enjoyed. You know, a million. None of them come to mind right now, but the million murder podcasts I've listened to. And he won't. And so he's a little kind of ignorant of the culture of it. Mm-hmm. So they're like, the very first episode, they're all listening to what, I mean, it does, it sounds very much like a Serial ripoff. It's called, I can't remember. It's like Something Happened in Oklahoma or whatever is the name of the fictional podcast that the three main characters are listening to. That's played by, Steve Martin, Martin Short, and, Selena Gomez. So they're all fans of this podcast, but they don't, you know, they don't really realize that there's like a moment in the show where they, you know, all kind of come together. But it's narrated by this character called, it sounds almost like Sarah Koenig. It's like Cinda Canning, played by Tina Fey.
Oh, of course.
And the music also like apes the Serial thing. It's all like piano, doop, doop, doop. You know, it's very, very much, you know, it just, you know, it's a parody of Serial. And so they're all like, there's a moment where like they're all kind of running into each other, realizing they listened to the podcast and yelling things like, what's in the dog's mouth? And where is she? You know, but it's like, they're all kind of like freaking out about the show. And I'm like, oh gosh, that's so much like what it's like. Like, I remember when I was working, when Serial first came out and I was working at the clinic, and I realized one of the psychiatrists was also listening to Serial. And we had a whole moment like that by the copy machine, where it was like, you know, what do you think? What is Jay doing? Like, what's going on? Like, why is he involved in, like, and it was just that kind of thing. And now suddenly you're banded together by this, like, you know, this murder, this terrible event that's like brings people together. So there's kind of that element of it that's really funny, especially in the first episode, as they're all like, you know, talking about it. And it just reminded me of like the early days of listening to My Favorite Murder and, you know, bonding and go, like, I went to some Murder Reno events, you know, we saw, you know, we went live, you know, to like the live show and all of that kind of thing. So it just, yeah, it has that element to it. But then on top of it, there's also this other, you know, the mystery of the show, you know, somebody's murdered in the building, that's the whole thing. And these characters decide to make a podcast about it. although it's, I don't know. We're kind of just getting to that, because I think there's like six or seven episodes out, and we've only listened to or only watched three. But it's fun. I think you'd enjoy it as a podcast maker, because there's stuff that you're just like, wait, that's not how, like, how are you making a show out of like nothing? Like, they have nothing, you know. But it's pretty good.
Well, I can. It's
we do that all the time. So.
Only Murders in the Building is one of those shows that's like, you should be watching this. Yeah. Like, staring at me from my queue every time I click on Dancing with the Stars. It's like, you actually should be watching this one, Joe.
Yeah, they're only 30 minute episodes, so, you know, it's one of those things you could probably just, you know. Yeah. And but it, see, is kind of addictive.
It's sitting right next to the last season of Shrill, so I'm like, you know, and again, I know that's 30 minute episodes, and it's just, you know, it's there. Because the other thing too is like when I want to start something new, I have like a wealth of things,
yeah,
to get through.
No, that I do understand. In our little group chat that I have with some of my friends, it like keeps coming up that like, oh, you know, have you seen this yet? You should watch this, or check this thing out. And I'm just like, I can't. It's just like books. Like, I have to finish some of these books before I start new books. Like, you know, but it's addictive when we live in this society with, like, there's so much content, you know, there's so many shows, there's so many, like, I just, sometimes I have, like, these surreal feelings of, like, what is out there that I've yet to see or listen to that I would love, you know, that I'd be obsessed with. But I also can't think like that because I already have, I have so much stuff to read and watch that, I mean, even if I watched it 24 hours a day until I died, I probably wouldn't catch up. So,
I mean, Joshua, this is a great place to remind you about mindfulness and the, you know, that thinking about the future, the unknown is the thief of mindfulness.
Thank you, Counselor Joe. Camp Counselor Joe to the rescue.
My name is Joe Brené Brown.
Oh my God, you're... all right, so that is definitely going to be the poll quote for this episode.
My name is Brené Brown. Joe Elizabeth Gilbert. You know, whatever. You know, insert some, like, white woman. I don't actually don't know. I don't know who Brené Brown is, so I don't know if she's a white woman or not. Someone look it up. I don't know. Every time, you know, I lump them all into, you know, a Cheryl Strayed, an Eat, Pray, Love, and Elizabeth Gilbert.
Yeah. No, Brené Brown, I do believe, is a white woman.
She is a white woman. She is a white woman.
Of course, again, you know, you never know. You can't just look at people and know for sure. So
I know. Look at Rachel Dolezal.
Oh, my gosh.
We couldn't tell she was a liar just by looking at her.
Oh, man, that was delightful. All right. Well, anyways, so it is enjoyable. I definitely think you should check it out sometime, especially as a fan of, like, you know, My Favorite Murder and, you know, those sorts of things. And just podcasts. It's just fun that, you know, the creation of a podcast is part of, like, the storyline. So, you know, it's a good time.
Okay.
Other than that, it's been, you know, I just... Yeah, I'm just waiting for I'm waiting for Halloween Kills to come out. You know, I'm waiting for, you know, all of these movies that I know that I like to watch throughout October. I'm ready to be watching all of those. So I'm going to be putting a lot of things on hold to do that.
Oh, okay.
Rewatching. And I've got plans, like, I'm doing showings, you know, people are coming over to hang out. So, you know, we're going to do, just ready.
Yeah, so everybody, you're on notice. Joshua's waiting.
Right. Actually, you know what's funny? It's like, I mean, not to sound popular, but my calendar's already, like, filled for October. So it's not even like I'm waiting. It's like I'm just, it's more of like just, you know, each day, which I love. I love this time of year. Like I said, it feels like my birthday. I wish I should just change my birthday legally to Halloween because, like, the month of October, like, really makes me feel, like, loved by friends and, you know, and it's that time of year that just reminds me of, like, you know, all the awesome people in my life and all the spooky kooks.
Do you ever feel like this is going to drastically bring things into reality? So, you know, feel free not to answer the question, but do you ever feel like sometimes you don't want to be known as the horror person?
No. No, I like it. I had, like, a weird, like, a few years ago, sort of a weird crisis about it, but I mean, this was like 8 years ago or something like that, where
this has to be pre-Fright School.
Yeah, definitely pre-Fright School. But we were hosting a lot of parties when we first moved here, and, like, the first couple of years, it's like every party, it was like a horror theme, you know? So, like, we had, like, a Valentine's Day party and it was like Bloody Valentine, and we, you know, it was all these horror things and, you know, all of these, like, just every party had that kind of theme. And so it was just like getting to be like a lot of blood and gore. And I think there were definitely, like, some people that were like, this is a lot. And so I had, like, a moment where I was like, ah, man, maybe we should, like, not every party has to have like a horror element to it. And I mean, we've definitely gotten away from that. Like now we, you know, we host like wine parties and we have, you know, dinners and, it's not like a horror film is always playing, but for a while there it was. So I did feel like for a moment I needed to kind of pull that back just because I didn't want to give like totally the wrong impression. Like I feel like, you know, maybe people are weird about stuff sometimes. So you just don't know. You just don't know how you're coming across. And if you're being like, and I'm very darkly like humorous, I think, and morbid. And so, you know, it's just like, sometimes it's like having to remind people, like I was talking about this in class, in my writing class, cause I'm working on an essay about like, you know, the sun going out and existential dread, but finding joy in that. And like, despite the fact that we wear a lot of black and, you know, we're always, you know, doing horror events and, you know, doing, you know, kind of, you know, we're morbid dudes. We're also extremely joyful and we have fun and our life is filled with like, you know, incredible music and food and friends and family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of joy, even though there's also a lot of black clothing and, you know, so I think it's more because it's sort of switched to that where it's like the death positivity thing too, of like being aware that we're going to die and that's okay. And we're better off, I think personally, if we're a little more aware of our mortality because we can embrace things a little easier. And I think there's a lot of my friends who it's like, you know, I want to shake a little bit, like you're going to die one day. So stop overthinking, you know, stop letting other people rule your life. So I don't know. Nowadays, I don't care. I'm getting too old. I don't give a fuck. I'm going to be that 80-year-old dude wearing skull and crossbones. And, you know, poor kids are going to think I am death wandering the streets of San Diego one day. So I'm fine with that.
In your walker without pants.
As long as they run away and keep the sidewalk clear for me and my walker and my no pants.
I bring it up because, like, you know, there are... Like for a long time, I was always like the trivia guy, and I think to a certain extent, I am that now. And I actually played trivia last night. The reason why we're recording on a different day than we usually do is because I'm attending a wedding this weekend for some friends who I met via trivia, and we played for the first time in like 4 or 5 years because we're all together, and. I was telling them, I was like, yeah, I'm not hosting anymore, but I like forgot how much I love to play trivia. And I also like forgot how much I, how really super duper like competitive I get when I play trivia. Like it gets annoying it can get annoying if you don't know me. And the place we were playing at was like super trendy. And as people started to come in, I looked at the team and I was like, I don't lose to hipsters. So, so we need to win. We're like, I don't lose to hipsters.
Did you win?
Of course we did. Of course we did. But that's the thing is that like, sometimes I struggle with like, you know, there are things that like are a part of you for a while, but then at a certain point, you know, do you like, I fight with like, am I trying to just be angsty and not be quote unquote known, or, you know, am I just like, what am I bucking against when I get those feelings of like, I don't want to be known as a trivia person. The thing that I love is like, I love being known as the horror guy right there with you. And what I've learned from you, not to get all sentimental on your ass, but what I've learned from you is to have like, to just have, let people have their joy and have the most joy in the things that make you really happy.
Yeah.
And to never, you know, to not spoil anyone's enjoyment of things as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and it's hard. Like there are definitely times where I want to make fun of shit, but then I'm just like, well, whose feelings am I going to hurt? You know, like whose whole identity is wrapped up in this thing in the way that my identity is so intertwined with horror, you know? Mm-hmm. So again, it is just like sondering and remembering that other people are as complex and complicated and have a right, you know, to things, which again is why I struggle with like, you know, I don't being, you know, this show, like there are shows out there that are funny and, you know, like that's their thing, making fun of horror or tearing somebody or saying this is, you know, the worst garbage ever or whatever. You know, that's definitely their thing and that's what they get joy out of. That's fine. But it's like, it's hard for me to like, I always am in this weird place of like, well, somebody probably really loves this thing, you know? And like, how am I to judge? Like, you know, so whatever. Yes, I agree. We have to just be kind to each other, even when we're hacking each other to pieces.
You really made me, I was really hesitant to, like, you know, share with you my music opinions for a few years, because you're just so, your music opinions and your taste is so cool, you know, capital C, cool.
I don't know about that, but thank you.
To me at least. And so then, like, I started to, like, it's only been in the last few years that I've, like, really owned, like, the type of music that I like. And yeah. I've been able to define, like, Jimmy Kinz's dad asked me, and he's a music guy. He plays guitar. Like, he has his kids over to play music and stuff. And so he asked me, like, what kind of music do you like? And I got, it was so strange, because I was like, I like a lot of female driven pop. He's like, oh, like who? And I was like, I'm like, oh, like, you know, like Kim Petras. And like, I started naming people, and I was like, oh my god, I'm definitely that person where it's like, let me pull out the coolest thing that I can think of to impress you. But now I'm just like, well, no, let me tell you how much I love, like, you know, this one novelty song by a Real Housewife. But yeah, and you know, spoiler alert for those who are listening, he asked me to choose the album we would listen to next, and so I put on the new YOLA. And
nice,
because it's a safe bet, and also she's, you know, I think more people should know about her.
Yeah, she's got an incredible voice. I love it. Oh, how sweet.
I know.
That's a nice place to stop and take a quick break, and then we're going to be back to discuss, what is it, 1971? 1971's The Blood on Satan's Claw.
Haley Piper, Patrick Lacey, S.E. Howard, Waylon Jordan, and Jeremy Herbert. Five acclaimed authors of horror and dark fiction. Their twisted tales appeared in the acclaimed horror anthology Worst Laid Plans from Grindhouse Press. Now, their tales of vacation terror are coming to the big screen in a feature film adaptation from Genre Blast Films. Five acclaimed genre filmmakers will bring these stories to life. Samantha Koyesnik, John Hale, Vanessa Yonta Wright, Michael Escobedo, and Jeremy Herbert. Worst Laid Plans. Now crowdfunding on Indiegogo. This is one vacation you'll be dying to take.
All right, welcome back. I'm so excited for today, because we are kicking off our October series, October 2021, Halloween 2021 set of films. And I'm really excited to get into this, because I've had this plan for like the whole year. I've like been thinking about these films, thinking about what we're going to do, you know, and kind of building this concept. So we are dedicating October to what's called this subgenre in horror called folk horror. We're going to look at some, you know, a set of films that are included in that, from foundational films to, you know, newer films, and sort of how folk horror has transformed and changed since, you know, the 60s into now. And I just really love this. I really love folk horror. We've done some folk horror on the show before, because we've covered like Children of the Corn. We've done The Witch. We saw Midsommar. So we've definitely kind of touched on it, but we've never done like a full on exploration of folk horror. And so I was partially inspired by this book I picked up, A Walk in a Darker Wood, an Anthology of Folk Horror, which was edited by Duane Pasiche, Sarah Walker, and Gordon B. White. And so we're going to be kind of using some of their conversation about folk horror, along with some other pieces here. So to start, a definition of folk horror. Usually, so I like this from the Wikipedia page for folkcore. It's kind of succinct. So it's saying that it's, you know, it's horror that uses elements of folkcore to invoke fear in its audience. That's like a simple kind of term. Typical elements include rural setting, themes of isolation, religion, the power of nature, and the potential darkness of rural landscapes. And although it can be connected to supernatural elements, not all of them are. You know, sometimes it's just the horror of people, of belief systems that are rooted in like the natural world, which I think it, within the context of folk horror, humanity and nature are sort of these like almost like a natural enemy. Mm-hmm. As like humanity, as we fight to tame nature and to destroy it and build our own kingdoms. Sometimes the natural world has to remind us of its power. And so we see that in, you know, in obviously what's happening right now in the midst of like climate change, but throughout our history, we know there have been devastating fires and hurricanes and tsunamis, you know, these sorts of things that are existentially horrifying to humans, and this like power that the natural world has. So I watched on YouTube, very exciting. So you can find this, Mark Gatiss, who is a writer and actor, did a 2010 BBC documentary series called A History of Horror. And I think it's a 3-part series. And the second part gets into a little bit of these films in the 60s and 70s. So obviously today we're starting with The Blood on Satan's Claw, which is considered to be part of like a trilogy of like foundational folk horror films, which also includes Witchfinder General, which stars Vincent Price, and The Wicker Man from 1973, which we will be doing The Wicker Man in this series. Spoiler alert. We may revisit Witchfinder General in the future, but I just decided we just did a film with Vincent Price, and I think that the elements in Blood on Satan's Claw and in The Wicker Man are just more, a little more interesting than Witchfinder General, but not to say anything negative about Witchfinder General. I would like to cover it on the show, but I think in the essence of getting to some of the bigger conversations of folk horror, we're going to just focus on two of those as part of the, at least the foundation of setting the tone for what's to come. And so I watched this documentary and it was really cool because he had the director of The Blood on Satan's Claw, Pierce Haggard, actually in this documentary. And so what is this? Like, this was set in this was created in 1971, released in 1971. And so 2010, I mean, that's almost what, 40 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To discuss, the film. So I'll get into some of that once we get into talking about the themes of the film, because he brought in the interview, he brought some really cool thoughts that I didn't notice upon first watching. So I'm really glad, because I actually watched this film early last year because I thought I was going to put it in our, because last October we dedicated to the devil, we dedicated to Satan, and you know, mm-hmm. sort of these various works and different iterations of the devil in horror. And so I was going to do this film then, but then I didn't feel like it wasn't actually kind of what I was trying to do. So I thought I would save it and dedicate, you know, and then it came up again. I was like, oh, perfect. We'll do a whole thing on folk horror. So in that documentary, Mark Gatiss, I love that he said this about folk horror. He says there's a common obsession with British landscapes, folklore, superstitions. And that there was this sort of, wider appreciation for like British, a British sensibility of horror. So I think that's probably where we will start with a kind of, you know, that's sort of how we're defining folk horror. Again, it is loose, within the terms of this film, we have a, what is it? It's like a pagan, a rural paganism. Mm-hmm. So within this film, it's very, it's a very beautiful film with this like underlying horror. So let's start now talking about the film itself with, like, as usual, Joe, what did you think of watching The Blood on Satan's Claw? Did you watch it on Tubi as well?
I watched it on Tubi, so it was nice. It was interspersed with, like, you know, commercials for Boniva and and all of those things.
Yeah, I hated that. I was like, oh my gosh, just get back to the film.
Yeah, no, just like we can't anymore. It was strange. I thought it was gonna be like, I was prepared for like a giallo fever dream. I really was.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised at how kind of linear it ended up being.
It's more of like a daydream.
Yeah, a little bit. And I mean, and again, like most, as is with most films that I do for Fright School, I watch it during the day. It's actually very rare that I watch anything at night. And so I'm kind of glad that I did for this one. It was also like, there were parts where it was so slow. And I was like, I get it. That's the convention of the time. They're building up tensions and, you know, tension and all of that. Like, I totally understand, but I just can't, you know, it didn't grab me. So, you know, it's not until like the end, right? Not until like they sacrifice poor Kathy, and it gets to that point where I'm just like, okay, now we're seeing some things happen. But yeah, interesting start. In fact, I, because I knew nothing about folk horror, I didn't know that it was its whole, I thought you were, honestly, I thought you were like making up the genre.
No, unfortunately, I am not the creator of this genre.
Yeah, or like, you know, like the concept of it. And so I did a little research myself, and I'm like, it's a whole thing. And so it made me appreciate it more. But, you know, this is probably not something I'd watch again. But it's definitely one of those films where it's like, I understand its place in the canon, and I have an appreciation for it. But
yeah. Yeah, you probably, I imagine you probably saw some of those reflection, like in watching it, you're probably going, oh, I kind of get where Midsommar is pulling from, or where The Witch is pulling from, or where Children of the Corn.
Absolutely.
You can feel the presence.
There's a scene, I forget what exactly is happening, but I think there's a scene where it's raining, and I was like the way that the shot was set up was like, it was The Witch. Like,
yeah.
Because there's those scenes in The Witch where it's raining, and it's like the way the rain falls over the thatched roof, and you're like looking at the townspeople. A little bit of Midsommar. And then also what was interesting is that the parts with the, you know, with the chanting and all that stuff and the group stuff, it reminded me, I'm sure maybe you've seen it, but I actually saw it independent of Fright School. It's a like a dark parody called The Love Witch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so like there were scenes where it kind of, like The Love Witch kind of spoofs the movies of like the 60s and 70s. And so
Right. There's
a scene there in The Love Witch that like I'm sure is a direct callback to The Blood on Satan's Claw.
So I think that's fair. Yeah.
And it was so cool to like see that, to see like this is one of those foundational texts where like now every time I watch a new movie or if I see a more recent movie, I know that this is a reference point for it, or there are homages to it.
Yeah.
And those are always really cool.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree. This isn't like a fun movie to like pop in and like hang out, you know, watching, you know, joyfully. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's definitely kind of slow. And I do think that, again, that is sort of a function of the time. You know, we're talking about 1971, premiered in April of 1971. You know, so like films of this time are just a little bit more meditative. It's very pastoral, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. Like it just has this. So it's set in 18th century England, and sort of what kicks off the events of the film is the discovery of this like creepy face skull thing with an eye still in it.
Mm-hmm. I think there was like a worm or a caterpillar.
Yeah, there is a worm, and you know, poor Ralph throughout this film. he discovers it, you know, tries to like warn the judge. What is his name?
I just kept calling him Judge Turpin.
I knew you were going to, this is so funny. I knew, I was like, oh, I know Joe's going to have like a Disney reference for this.
Judge Turpin is a Sondheim reference.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of,
Claude Frollo.
No, Radcliffe. Is that his name in Pocahontas? Oh, Radcliffe. Cause just his outfit, his cape and stuff. I was
Governor Radcliffe from Pocahontas.
Yes, I'm so sorry. You're right. Judge Turpin. Okay. Yeah,
I kept calling him Judge Turpin, and the square was like, he reminded me of Beetle Bamford.
Beetle Bamford,
The squire is the most judge, Governor Radcliffe-y of them all.
That's true. That's true. That's so fun. Well, I mean, that's so on brand right there for me to totally like mistake a Disney character. Turpin. Yes, it's Radcliffe. Anyways, whatever. Point is, I figured you'd have some sort of gay reference for that.
Yes.
So I love that he's totally dismissive. Like, he's like, you know, what? Like, no, I'm not here for your superstition. And then, of course, he, like, takes off, leaving this poor town abandoned to its, like, growing superstitious fears.
Which, can we talk about how that seems to be a thing that happens a lot in movies of this period? Like, people leave. And again, it's like, it's great because, like, you know, the internet doesn't exist yet. So, like, if you need to go consult someone, you actually have to, like, fly off to the Vatican. Like, you can't just email a priest, you know?
Right.
You have to fly. I forget what movie was it. I think it was either Suspiria or Rosemary's Baby, where like someone leaves and goes to get like a book and then comes back, or, you know, gathers more information about like the building or something like that. So it's Suspiria I'm thinking about. Like, she has to like go to Rome to like learn more about the building and all this stuff. But that's the thing, is that, like, I feel like I see that a lot in these like 60s, 70s films, because, you know, this is a good case for the internet at this point.
I was gonna say, this is like the most horrifying thing for you. It's like, these people have no internet.
Yeah.
What are they gonna do?
They can't pop in Encarta and, you know, look up what is it? Behemoth? What is
it? Yeah, the Behemoth. They may say it. Whatever, Behemoth, that they're like kind of calling to, whether that's actually Satan. It's kind of like The Exorcist. Like, is it just a demon or is it the devil? Yeah.
Is it Pazuzu? You know? Like, they, I feel
which
like,
is, you know, that is the demon, but saying it's the devil. So,
yeah. Which, like, I feel like we can have, like, that'll be a fun, like, day long film festival of, like, all the princes of hell. So, like, we'll have Satanic Panic with Samael, you know, and then, you know, Beelzebub and Azazel and all of them. And then we'll, but anyway, please continue. I've derailed us enough with homosexuality.
It's totally fine. So this is another film that I think, one of the reasons I really like this film is it's set in the 18th century, but the writer was very much inspired by very contemporary issues. So when they wrote this, it was like a direct response to the Mary Bell murders of 1968, and then also the Manson family, the Tate-LaBianca murders that happened in 1969. And so again, we sort of have this conversation going on in horror that we've had in the past, where like the values of the society seem to be breaking down. It's like this apocalyptic sort of conversation that happens in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for instance, you know, where sort of like family values get, you know, subverted. Mm-hmm. And so I really like how this film is really like, we can tie it directly to those murders and those events, not only in the reading of the film and the understanding of what's happening in the film, but also because we have like the writers actually talking about it. And I'm going to share this. This is from Horror Homeroom, Refractions of Mary Bell and the Blood of Satan's Claw, examining Angel, Kathy, and Margaret, our main like women in the film. So do you know much about the Mary Bell case?
No.
Okay. So Mary Bell she's still alive. She's an adult now, in her 60s.
Is her name Mary Bell or is it Mary Bell?
Well, it's Mary Flora Bell. Mary Bell.
Okay.
It's first and last name.
Okay.
It's kind of also Asylum, the American Horror Story Asylum. Remember the little girl, like, killer? It's like she's, you know, like that. Like, that's okay. Another reference. So she was this little girl who, in 1968, murdered two young boys, I think ages of like three or four. And by strangulation. And it was kind of this really shocking crime when they discovered it was like this little girl. She was, I think, 10 when it happened, but she turned 11 either right before her trial or when it began, sometime shortly after. I'm not too shaky on the details, or I'm not too clear on the details. I mean, I am shaky on the details, clearly. But anyways, the point is that she murdered these two young boys, kind of shocking, you know, Britain. This happened in Newcastle upon Tyne.
Okay.
And so the second murder is sort of interesting when compared to the blood on Satan's claw, because, you know, not only did she strangle this boy, but she then used a pair of scissors to, like, you know, content warning, mutilate him a little bit, and then she cut off some of his hair. And so we see in this film, like, the sort of direct relation to Angel. She's a demon, whatever she calls her. It's, you know, again, she's like this beautiful blonde girl who's like leading this whole town to satanic sex rituals. But there's that whole, like, really intense, we should have started with a content warning, because there is, like, a rape scene in this film, as, you know, every horror fucking film in the 60s and 70s, if there's not a rape, you know, then I just don't know what they were doing, it seems. But that whole scene where she, like, uses the, you know, it's like shears, she's using shears to, like, stab Kathy and then, like, cut off, like, the fur. It was just, like, there was these very, like, clear allusions to, like, that case. And kind of this examination of you know, the values that seem to be, like, plummeting, because you had, like, the Summer of Love happen in 1969, Woodstock. There's this whole, like, that's one of the things that the director talks about. He's like, I keep forgetting his name, Pierce Haggard. I kind of blocked that Pierce name out of my brain because of Pierce Morgan, who I hate. So
was it spelled like Pierce Morgan?
Yeah, it's like P-I-E-R-S. Oh,
okay. I just think of Pierce Brock, but that's Pierce, not Piers, but, you know.
Oh, yeah, Pierce, no, Pierce. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Pierce Morgan. He's, like, terrible. I hate him. So I don't even think about that name. But anyways, Pierce Haggard. And he talks about, like, you know, at the time we were all obsessed with witchcraft, free love, nudity, this breakdown of values. You know, so in working on the film, was sort of like pulling in these, like, sort of direct references. What I love is this whole movie. This is another one of those things where it's like, you know, do you know where your children are and what they are doing?
Yeah, this could fall under creepy children for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. And again, it's so interesting because, you know, just a few years later, a decade later, you know, the nation would be, like, gripped with satanic panic. And this film is like a perfect, like, this is another one where it's like, I almost wish that there wasn't an actual demon or devil about, because I think there's, like, a really powerful metaphor at play here of, like, how we, like, create, like, the fact that, like, the devil. So this film, I think its name changed a couple times. So I think it was originally titled, shoot, what was it? It was shot under the title The Devil's Something. Oh, gosh, I can't find it. I knew I should have written it down. But anyways, so it had a working title of Satan's Skin. And then it became The Blood on Satan's Claw. But I think there was even a third name being considered. But regardless, I like this idea that, you know, you have, like, this isolated town, it seems. You know, everybody knows each other. They're all kind of doing whatever. And then they're gripped by this, like, panic. And the fact that, like, the devil needs, like, pieces of everybody in order to rebuild itself, or themself, mm-hmm. himself, whatever, is happening. It's, like, this sort of, like, our imagination, like, pieces of us, like, creates the devil, you know, together. So, like, the more this spreads, like, the more powerful this, like, imaginative experience, you know, this happens. Again, I could say that about, you know, religious, you know, fervor, you know, it's kind of that sort of thing. And so it's like, I almost wish that that was more at play here rather than the actual devil. But regardless, I still think the metaphor kind of, or the, you know, that sort of still holds, you know, that, like, mm-hmm. all of these children are helping to contribute, you know, and they're, like, giving pieces of themselves to, like, rebuild this creature.
Can I offer up something?
Yeah.
Well, like, I think that, because, I mean, as true crime people know, right, you know, Manson, I think this is, like, the central plot point of Mindhunters, is, like, Manson, like, creates the need for, like, the behavioral, like, the behavioral psychology unit of the FBI to get into the mind of serial killers and such and such. So it's, like, it makes sense to me that, while, yes, narrative speaking and in a modern context, we probably, it would be the bigger twist is, like, you know, the monster is us. The monster's always been us.
Yeah.
But I feel like at the time, we needed the monster to be not us.
Right.
Right. We need the monster to be the devil. We need the monster to be genuinely evil because we have not yet come to terms with the fact that, like, we are the monster. And that's something, like, in kind of the short little blurbs and articles that I've read about folk horror is really interesting because, like, folk horror is also presenting itself from a colonial lens. And in that point, it's like, okay, we need the monster to be the devil, or we need it because, you know, the violence of colonialism is being, we can't see, and the natural world coming to get us. Like, you know, it's interesting. I think there's like a, correlation there. And I think, like, the witch does a job of, like, spinning that on its head, you know, like good job commenting on the colonial aspect of it. Modern, like, folk horror stuff does a good job of talking about, like, the colonial imperial aspect of, like, folk horror. And that's, like, the whole thing I was reading. Cause, like, I thought, are we in colonial times or are we in, like, the English countryside? And it sounds, mm-hmm. and I was like, okay, we're definitely in the English countryside. And even then it still reads, it can't help but read colonial for me.
Yeah. I actually think that's a beautiful, thought, absolutely, and analysis. And you're absolutely right. I mean, again, when we're talking about people responding to cultural events with horror, there is, especially at this time, I mean, it's not as if the Mary Bell murders or the Manson murders were the first, you know, horrific thing to happen. I obviously, plenty of horrifying cases had happened before and, you know, shocked people. And that goes way back, you know. Mm-hmm. But on such, like, a national scale during a time of, like, you know, these conversations around, like, peace, love, and understanding, you know, I just think that there was, or a global, really, like, a global conversation. But anyways, you're absolutely right, because they were sort of, like, obviously directly inspired by, you know, this horror that's happening. It is in that, like, we're not in that, like, almost like postmodern phase of, like, now where we can make horror and, like, lead you down a path that it's supernatural. And then you find out it's really not, that it's, like, in somebody's mind. Mm-hmm. We've embraced our true horror in a little bit of a way. I mean, the director said that, like, you know, again, this was, like, dark things that were real and happened, like, is something, like, he was trying to talk about, but obviously he made a supernatural film. So he is seeking an explanation, and you're right to give that to audiences, where it's like, this beautiful blonde blue-eyed happy girl, like, you know, she's not evil on her own, and just like Mary Bell, like, and that, like, conversation, like, in the media, that's one of the things in this paper is examining. He's saying, what he calls it, refractions of Mary Bell, because he's like, you have these three girls with Kathy, which interesting, the word, the name Catherine means pure. Hmm. So Catherine's the one who's like sacrificed, you know, she has this like ritualistic sexual assault happened to her. You know, she's like, this lamb who's slaughtered. That's like Mary Bell's innocence because, you know, her mother abused her. She had a very violent childhood. So, you know, that's kind of represents this part of Mary Bell that the media was talking about. Like, we have to remember she's a little girl and, mm-hmm. you know, she didn't just become a murderer. And then you have like the, you know, Angel and Margaret representing these other versions, which are like Angel's almost like a mother figure who's also violently enacting, you know, these ritualistic abuses, and then Margaret also encouraging it, almost a go-between between the two of mm-hmm. them. And so
a little Leslie Van Houten, right?
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. You kind of get these different analyses, for, you know, based on like your own perspectives, like when journalists are writing or the courts are, you know, the justice system, as it were, when they're kind of trying to figure out the motives for events, you know, as it goes out, everybody has a thought, everybody has like, you know, a response. And so I do kind of like that idea. And so, of course, again, going back to what you're saying, because it's the 70s, we're not ready to just be like, maybe a child is just fucking evil. You know, mm-hmm. maybe some kids are awful. Maybe some things happen because we're bad people. It has nothing to do with the devil. It has nothing to do with God. It's just like, you know, some of us suck for whatever reasons. But, you know, to talk about that on film is a very different thing than to maybe say, you know, talk about yeah. it at a trial or whatever. And kind of, yeah, horror in this situation is trying to organize that fear, like, how does this happen? How do you get this like angelic child to a place that they are, you know, this evil, this container, this mm-hmm. vessel of evil. So I love that. And you're absolutely right too, about like the full core. Like we've talked about that before with, and again, I guess in defining folk horror on film, that's one thing, but then folk horror, as we've been talking for centuries, is kind of a different thing, you know? So when we talk about like, and we'll do a little bit of that. I've got a couple films ideas, for looking at like, indigenous stories, indigenous horror, and the ways like colonialism, mm-hmm. like affects that, you know, and that sort of, you know, destruction of the land and how it will respond, I think is exciting. So I like that you're bringing that into the conversation, because we should definitely talk about that as we progress in this little series.
Mm-hmm. You're getting me excited, Joshua, and I love it. This is why after 6 years, Fright School still is great.
I think we're only at like 5 years. I feel like we keep adding a year, but I don't know. I feel like we lost time.
Well, we're coming up on six, so.
Are we? I thought we started in 2016. I don't know. We don't have to figure this out. Yeah. let's see. Just going through my notes. I wrote like two pages of notes for this because there is a lot to unpack in this. And again, because it sets up so many other films, like we've already talked about. Let's see. Well, actually, I think that pretty much covers a lot of like what we're talking about. One of the things I think is interesting too about this movie that I was reading in some of the discourse is mm-hmm. like, you know, because so the judge at the beginning, obviously he's like this powerful man in this situation. He like leaves, and in his absence, all of this hell breaks loose, and this, you know, this woman, this blonde, beautiful child, like, you know, creates a death cult in his town, and he returns, and he's the one that's going to like,
and he provides order.
Right. He comes back and provides order. But I don't know, like, is that, I feel like there's a few like there's loose ends in this film, which I'm not sure if that's like purposeful or not. Cause they do this weird echo thing where at the beginning of the film, we find this skull with its one eye.
Yeah.
And then at the end, in the fire, when it freezes, it's like the same eye on like the guy who's setting order. Hmm. So it's like, I felt like they was trying to make like a very clear, like, I don't know. There's something about like the crimes of man and like the crimes of the patriarchy in a way. Yeah. And like, again, kind of what you're talking about, like colonialism, imperialism, like, you know, sort of that invasion. But I don't know. I feel like that's one of the things in the film. I want to watch it again with more of like, I wasn't really watching it with like a feminist lens, because I'm not sure it holds up to that. You know, so it's just kind of a little messy. I feel like the ending is a little weird, where I'm not, you know, the overall point of the film. And one of the things that I was thinking about is like, you know, the message feels a little confused, but that maybe at the end of the day, that might actually be the point. Like, you know, how do you truly explain such evil? Like, how do you really wrap up, you know, something that is possibly eternal, you know, in within the context of the film? And like, how do we, you know, how do we organize our thoughts around that? So I don't know. Again, I'm not saying like,
I think that we can't, I don't, I think that we, you and I, it's like children of the witch, you know, children of the Vavitch, like, we can't unsee the lesson or unknow the lesson that perhaps the person who is supposed to be the savior is the one who's the really shitty one.
Right.
Like, we can't unsee that lesson. Like, I think that's one of the things about the witch, right? Is that everything, you see the larger, there was a larger hand at play, but there ultimately that led to Thomason's freedom, right? That led to her liberation. And so in this regard, it's like...
Possibly, yeah. Again, what is the context, the liberation, or is now she, like, enslaved to the devil? You know, it's like with Chaos, with Sabrina, with you know, where it's like, you know, well, I'm giving up freedom, right? It's like, I am tying myself now to the devil as my master, rather than a man, a human man. But go ahead, sorry.
But that's one of the things that I actually really love about Chaos, is that it's like, okay, well, you know, the devil gives you all these gifts, but at the same time requires, like, you know, your soul.
Right.
Like, so, and you can, like, you can revel in the, like, you don't have to have restraint, but at the same time, it's like, you know, the cost is your soul. And so, like, in that regard with the eye, that's such a good, interesting point. But the way I read it was like, it was kind of like a, I'm not gone type of thing. Like, you did this now, but you're not going to be there the next time. Like, I'm going to come back as, you know, the baby of a woman named Rosemary. You know, like it was almost a defiant look. Like,
but it was the judge's eye. Like, that's the thing at the end.
But that's what I'm saying.
The judge in the flame. Oh, I see what you're, like, the composition of it. It's like, okay. Yeah. Like, how do you really fight this fire? You know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I might have, again, I probably will watch this again at some point, because I am now kind of curious. I'm starting to think about, you know, sort of these, like, is there a feminist message at play here? Like, is it about, like, the, you know, like, women left alone, which was such, like, a thing, especially at this time. We're talking about the 18th century. We're talking about a religious, you know, we've got, like, this priest who, by the way, you know, they got their, like, you know, local priest dude who they've got, like, they immediately turn on. I love that. Like, they believe that girl right away. I do think that's an interesting thing. You know, you have this, like, well-respected man in the community, and that she's like, evil angel, I mean, is like, he's a bad man. And they, like, trust her. And I think that's interesting, you know, in the context of this. It's not like, you crazy girl, like, you know, that's the priest, have respect. I do like that. So I don't know. It's a mixed messaging. Mm-hmm. But still, it's like, yeah, exactly. Like, the wanton, like, needs of, you know, the feminine, like, you know, destroying this town, and then, like, the judge comes back and reasserts authority. So, but is that what's happening? I'm not sure. I might have to watch it again. Okay. I was paying more attention to, like, the Mary Bell references that I thought were really fascinating. You know, the idea of, like, the Manson murders, you know, the Tate LaBianca murders in particular, kind of playing into this. You know, so that's kind of what I was looking at and thinking about, you know, the, like, the, just the pastoral kind of thing. Oh, to that effect, I did like, there was a comment in that documentary I was talking about earlier from the director about the camera angles, mm-hmm. how like they, it was very like, the film's very painterly, like they were trying to, like they dug holes and set the camera like down into the ground mm-hmm. so that they could like do these shots that were almost coming from the earth. You know, like yeah. this constant like reminder of like, you know, the film opens with like mud and the what do you call it? The plow, like the wheels, like, you know, going through the dirt, like this very like real sense of like the natural world, and then framing all of these like beautiful, you know, the skies. And then like during that scene where, you know, before, you know, Kathy's assault and murder, like, you know, they have like these beautiful tree branches with like these flowers on them, and they put a flower crown on her and it seems very beautiful. But then they use that to like, they're like beating them with like mm-hmm. the branches. And it's just kind of, there's this whole perversion of like the natural world, you know, this beautiful like countryside and the, again, I just think is really, really interesting and really unsettling.
Yeah.
It's another film that pretty much takes place all during the day. I mean, besides the beginning where what's her name, Rosalind, like, you know, freaks out in the house and, yeah, and they take her away. But most of this film,
which is like that woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the, oh, yeah. The mistress.
Bantam.
Yeah. Yeah. Bantam. Yeah, that besides that kind of scene, most of it does take, it's just, I don't know, there's just moments of this film that are really beautiful to look at. And again, it is that like, you know, when you're sitting there at a lovely beach and you're looking at the beautiful skyline and the calm ocean, how it can suddenly turn on you, or, you know, you go to your favorite hike and, you know, you get lost, you know, like how very quickly the natural world can turn on you. And then vice versa, how very quickly we can turn as part of the natural world, turn on each other and use our fears of what hides in the woods as like weapons mm-hmm. against each other. Have you seen The Village?
Not from the beginning. I've actually seen the end of The Village.
Okay. I don't know. I'm only bringing it up because it's kind of that thing too, where it's like, you know, one of the effects of the film of keeping everybody in this village is by telling them there are monsters hiding in the woods. It's mm-hmm. this really powerful, you know, deterrent from wandering off and discovering, you know, the twist in the film. So, yeah, I don't know. Anyways, so that was 1971's Blood on Satan's Claw. Again, like I said, I've been very, very excited for this series. It's there's so much, like there's folk horror present in a lot of films, and I'm just excited to you know, dig in.
You know what, Joshua, Jester, you've done it again. you've got me all excited for something that I didn't even think I was going to be remotely excited for, to be completely honest.
Well, we'll see how it goes, because we still have a few more films to get through, and some of them are quite something. So, but you know, again, they have common themes, so it's gonna be fun. Alrighty, well, dear listener, you know, happy spooky season! Oh my gosh, here we are again, celebrating another year of Fright School, mm-hmm. and however many years it is, and we'll figure that out, and you know. It's so fun. Yay, Joe.
I can't wait.
Alrighty. Well, good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
Ha 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 ha!